Hello, everyone. We are continuing on with the mortification of sin in believers from John Owen. And last time we did chapter 8. It was a short chapter with a few points. The points were the second general rule proposed that without universal sincerity for the mortifying of every lust, no lust will be mortified. And again, lust is more generally any corrupt desire of the heart. Partial mortification always from a corrupt principle, and the perplexity of temptation from a lust oftentimes is a chastising for other negligences. And that brought us up to chapter 9, where we left off last time. And Lord willing, we're going to continue on in chapter 9 this time. And I'll go ahead and begin. The points in this chapter are particular directions in relation to the foregoing case proposed. First, consider the dangerous symptoms of any lust. And then he has some subpoints. Number one, inveterateness. Number two, peace obtained under it, the several ways whereby that is done. Three, frequency of success in its seductions. Number four, the soul's fighting against it with arguments only taken from the event. Number five, it's being attended with judiciary hardness. Number six, it's withstanding particular dealings from God. And then the state of persons in whom these things are found. Now he begins overall Roman numeral 3. The foregoing general rules being supposed particular directions to the soul for its guidance under the sense of a disquieting lust or distemper being the main thing I aim at, those come next to be proposed. Now of these, some are previous and preparatory, and in some of them the work itself is contained. Of the first sort are these ensuing, the following. First, consider what dangerous symptoms your lust has attending or accompanying it, whether it has any deadly mark on it or not. If it has, extraordinary remedies are to be used, extraordinary ones, and ordinary courts of mortification will not do it. You will say, what are these dangerous marks and symptoms? The desperate attendancies of an indwelling lust that you intend? He says, some of them I shall name. Number one, inveterateness. If it has laid long corrupting in your heart, if you have suffered it or allowed it to abide in power and prevalency without attempting vigorously the killing of it and the healing of the wounds you have received by it for some long season, your distemper is dangerous. Have you permitted worldliness, ambition, greediness of study to eat up other duties, the duties wherein you ought to hold constant communion with God for some long season? Or uncleanness to defile your heart with vain and foolish and wicked imaginations for many days? Your lust has a dangerous symptom. So was the case with David. Psalm 38, verse 5, my wounds stink and are corrupt because of my foolishness. When a lust has laid long in the heart, corrupting, festering, cankering, it brings the soul to a woeful condition. In such a case, an ordinary course of humiliation will not do the work. Whatever it be, it will by this means insinuate itself more or less into all the faculties of the soul and habituate the affections to its company and society. It'll get you used to it being there as common and familiar and okay. It grows familiar to the mind and conscience that they do not startle at it as a strange thing. They don't anymore, but are bold with it as that which they are wanted or often to do, or common or most likely to do, or usually. Yea, it will get such advantage by this means as oftentimes to exert and put forth itself without having any notice taken of it at all, as it seems to have been with Joseph in his swearing by the life of Pharaoh. Unless some extraordinary course be taken, such a person has no ground in the world to expect that his latter end shall be peace. For, first, how will he be able to distinguish between the long abode of an unmortified lust and the dominion of sin, which cannot befall a regenerate person? Secondly, how can he promise himself that it shall ever be otherwise with him, or that his lust will cease tumultuating and seducing, when he sees it fixed and abiding, and has done so for many days, and has gone through a variety of conditions with him? It may be he has tried mercies and afflictions, and those possibly so remarkable that the soul could not avoid the taking special notice of them. It may be it has weathered out many a storm and passed under much variety of gifts in the administration of the word. And will it prove an easy thing to dislodge an inmate pleading a title by prescription? Old neglected wounds are often mortal and always dangerous. Indwelling distempers grow rusty and stubborn by a continuance in ease and quiet. Lust is such an inmate as, if it can plead time and some prescription, will not easily be ejected. As it never dies of itself, it's just not going to go away. So if it be not daily killed, it will always gather strength. And that was point number one, inveterateness. Number two, secret pleas of the heart for the countenancing of itself and keeping up its peace, notwithstanding the abiding of a lust, without a vigorous gospel attempt for its mortification, is another dangerous symptom of a deadly distemper in the heart. Now, there be several ways whereby this may be done. I shall name some of them as, number one, when upon thoughts, perplexing thoughts about sin, instead of applying himself to the destruction of it, a man searches his heart to see what evidences he can find of a good condition, notwithstanding that sin and lust, so that it may go well with him. So he tries to justify himself in a way. For a man to gather up his experiences of God, to call them to mind, to collect them, consider, try, improve them, is an excellent thing in and of itself, a duty practiced by all the saints, commending in the Old Testament and the New. This was David's work when he communed with his own heart and called to remembrance the former loving kindness of the Lord, Psalm 77, verses 6 through 9. This is the duty that Paul sets us to practice, 2 Corinthians 13, verse 5. And as it is in itself excellent, so it has beauty added to it by a proper season, a time of trial or temptation, or disquietness of the heart about sin, is a picture of silver to set off this golden apple, as Solomon speaks. But now, to do it for this end or purpose, to satisfy conscience, which cries and calls for another purpose, besides that one, is a desperate device of a heart in love with sin. When a man's conscience shall deal with him, when God shall rebuke him for the sinful distemper of his heart, if he, instead of applying himself to get that sin pardoned in the blood of Christ and mortified by his Spirit, his Holy Spirit, if he shall relieve himself by any such other evidences as he has or thinks himself to have, and so disentangle himself from under the yoke that God was putting on his neck, his condition is very dangerous. His wound is hardly curable. Thus, the Jews, under the gallings of their own consciences and the convincing preaching of our Savior, supported themselves with this, that they were Abraham's children, and on that account accepted with God. They were accepted with God then because of that. And so they countenanced themselves in all abominable wickedness to their utter ruin. This is, in some degree, a blessing of a man's self in saying that upon one account or other he shall have peace, although he adds drunkenness to thirst. Love of sin, undervaluation of peace, and of all tastes of love from God are enwrapped in such a frame. Such a one plainly shows that if he can but keep up hope of escaping the wrath to come, he can be well content to be unfruitful in the world, at any distance from God that is not final separation. What is to be expected from such a heart? So that was sub point one, upon perplexing thoughts about sin, instead of trying to destroy it. They look for evidences of other goods in themselves. Number two, by applying grace and mercy to an unmortified sin or one not sincerely endeavored to be mortified, is this deceit carried on. This is a sign of a heart greatly entangled with the love of sin. When a man has secret thoughts in his heart, not unlike those of Naaman about his worshiping in the house of Rimmon, in 2 Kings 5 verse 18, in all other things I will walk with God, but in this thing God be merciful unto me. If it's like that, this person's condition is sad. It is true indeed, a resolution to this purpose, to indulge a man's self in any sin on the account of mercy, seems to be, and doubtless in any course is, altogether inconsistent with Christian sincerity and is a badge of a hypocrite, and it is the turning of the grace of God into wantonness, Jude verse 4. Yet I doubt not, but through the craft of Satan and their own remaining unbelief, the children of God may themselves sometimes be ensnared with this deceit of sin, or else Paul would never have so cautioned them against it as he does in Romans 6, verses 1 to 2. Yea, indeed, there is nothing more natural than for fleshly reasonings to grow high and strong upon this account. The flesh would fain be indulged unto upon the account of grace, and every word that is spoken of mercy, it stands ready to catch at and to pervert it to its own corrupt aims and purposes. To apply mercy, then, to a sin not vigorously mortified is to fulfill the end of the flesh upon the gospel. It's to basically abuse the gospel to allow you to live in the flesh. These and many other ways and wiles a deceitful heart will sometimes make use of to countenance itself in its abominations. Now, when a man with his sin is in this condition, that there is a secret liking of the sin prevalent in his heart, and though his will be not wholly or fully set upon, or he won't set upon it wholly or fully, yet he has an imperfect velleity toward it, he would practice it were it not for such and such considerations, and hereupon he relieves himself other ways than by the mortification and pardon of it in the blood of Christ, and that man's wounds stink and are corrupt, and he will, without speedy deliverance, be at the door of death. That was point two, secret pleas of the heart for the countenancing of itself to keep the peace. Number three, subpoint three, frequency of success in sin's seduction in obtaining the prevailing consent of the will unto it is another dangerous symptom. And this is what I mean. When the sin spoken of gets the consent of the will with some delight, though it be not actually outwardly perpetrated, yet it has success. So if you don't actually commit the sin, but you would like to, there's success, and it's a dangerous condition. A man may not be able, upon outward considerations, to go along with sin to that which James calls the finishing of it, James 1 verses 14 and 15, as to the outward acts of sin, when yet the will of sinning may be actually obtained. And then it has, in this condition, I say, success. The sin does, even though it's not actually acted out. Now, if any lust be able thus far to prevail in the soul of a man in that way and to that degree, as his condition may possibly be very bad and himself be unregenerate, so it cannot possibly be very good, but dangerous. And it is all one upon the matter whether this be done by the choice of the will or by inadvertency, for that inadvertency itself is in a manner chosen. When we are inadvertent and negligent, where we are bound to watchfulness and carefulness, that inadvertency does not take off from the voluntariness of what we do. For although men do not choose and resolve to be negligent and inadvertent, yet, if they choose the things that will make them so, They choose inadvertency itself as a thing that may be chosen in its cause. And let men not think that the evil of their hearts is in any measure extenuated because they seem, for the most part, to be surprised into that consent which they seem to give unto it. For it is negligence of their duty and watching over their hearts that betrays them into that surprisal. That was point three, frequency of success in sin's seduction, even just in the heart or in the will and mind. Point four, when a man fights against his sin only with arguments from the issue or the punishment due to it, this is a sign that sin has taken great possession of the will and that in the heart there is a superfluity of naughtiness. Such a man as opposes nothing to the seduction of sin and lust in the heart but fear of shame among men or hell from God is sufficiently resolved to do the sin if there were no punishment attending it, which, what it differs from living in the practice of sin, I know not. Those who are Christ's and are acted in their obedience upon gospel principles have the death of Christ, the love of God, the detestable nature of sin, the preciousness of communion with God, a deep-grounded abhorrency of sin as sin. They have all those things to oppose to any seduction of sin, to all the workings, strivings, and fightings of lust in their hearts. And in this way, Joseph had. How shall I do this great evil, he said, and sin against the Lord, my good and gracious God? Genesis 39, verse 9. And Paul said, the love of Christ constraineth us, in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 14, and having received these promises, let us cleanse ourselves from all pollution of the flesh and spirit, 2 Corinthians 7, verse 1. But now, if a man be so under the power of his lust that he has nothing but law to oppose it withal, if he cannot fight against it with gospel weapons, but deals with it altogether with hell and judgment, which are the proper arms of the law, it is most evident that sin has possessed itself of his will and affections to a very great prevalency and conquest. Such a person has cast off, as to the particular spoken of, the conduct of renewing grace, and is kept from ruin only by restraining grace. And so far is he fallen from grace and returned under the power of the law. And can it be thought that this is not a great provocation to Christ, that men should cast off his easy, gentle yoke and rule, and cast themselves under the iron yoke of the law, merely out of indulgence unto their lusts? Now try yourself by this also. When you are by sin driven to make a stand, and so that you must either serve it and rush at the command of it into folly, like the horse into the battle, or make headway against it to suppress it, what do you say to your soul? What do you expostulate with yourself? Is the following the only thing you say? Hell will be the end of this course. Vengeance will meet with me and find me out. It is time for you, and if that's the case, it is time for you to look about yourself. Evil lies at the door. Paul's main argument to evince that sin shall not have dominion over believers, that they are not under the law but under grace, Romans 6, 14. If your contendings against sin be all on legal accounts, from legal principles and motives, what assurance can you attain unto that sin shall not have dominion over you? And that will be your ruin, if sin does have dominion over you. Yea, know that this reserve will not long hold out. If your lust has driven you from stronger gospel forts, it will speedily prevail against this also. Do not suppose that such considerations will deliver you when you have voluntarily given up to your enemy those helps and means of preservation which have 1,000 times their strength. Rest assuredly in this, that unless you recover yourself with speed from this condition, the thing that you fear will come to you. What gospel principles do not, legal motives cannot do. That was point number four. When a man fights against sin only with arguments from the issue itself or legal arguments and the punishment, that's a dangerous condition. Number five, when it is probable that there is or may be somewhat of judiciary hardness or at least of chastening punishments in your lust as disquieting. This is another dangerous symptom. That God does sometimes leave even those of his own under the perplexing power, at least of some lust or sin, to correct them for former sins, negligence and folly, I no way doubt, so that he believes that God does do that even to his own sometimes. He leaves them to some lust because of other ones. Hence was that complaint of the church, why hast thou hardened us from the fear of thy name, Isaiah 63 verse 17. That this is his way of dealing with unregenerate men, no man questions. But how shall a man know whether there be anything of God's chastening hand in his being left to the disquietment of his distemper? Answer, examine your heart and ways. What was the state and condition of your soul before you fell into the entanglements of that sin which now has you complaining of? Had you been negligent of duties? Have you lived inordinately to yourself? Is there the guilt of any great sin lying upon you unrepented of? A new sin may be permitted, as well as a new affliction sent, to bring an old sin to remembrance. Have you received any eminent mercy, protection, deliverance, which you did not improve in due manner, or you weren't thankful for? Or have you been exercised with any affliction without laboring for the appointed end or purpose of it? Or have you been wanting or lacking the opportunities of glorifying God in your generation, which in his good providence he has graciously afforded to you? Or have you conformed yourself to the world and the men of it through the abounding of temptations in the days wherein you live? If you find this to have been your state, awake, call upon God. You are fast asleep in a storm of anger round about you. That was point five. Number six, when your lust has already withstood particular dealings from God against it. This condition is described in Isaiah 57 verse 17. For the iniquity of his covetousness was I wroth and smote him. I hid me and was wroth. And he went on forwardly in the way of his heart. God had dealt with them about their prevailing lust, and that several ways, by affliction and desertion. But they held out against all of that. This is a sad condition, which nothing but mere sovereign grace, as God expresses it in the next verse, can relieve a man in, and which no man ought to promise himself or bear himself upon. God oftentimes, in his providential dispensations, meets with a man and speaks particularly to the evil of his heart, as he did to Joseph's brethren in their selling of him into Egypt. This makes the man reflect on his sin and judge himself in particular for it. God makes it to be the voice of the danger, affliction, trouble, sickness that he is in or under. Sometimes in reading the word, God makes a man stay on something that cuts him to the heart and shakes him as to his present condition. More frequently, in the hearing of the word preached, his great ordinance for conviction, conversion, and edification, does he meet with men in that way. God often hews men by the sword of his word in that ordinance and strikes directly on their bosom-beloved lust. He startles the sinner, makes him engage unto the mortification and relinquishment of the evil of his heart. Now, if his lust has taken such hold on him as to enforce him to break these bands of the Lord and to cast these cords from him, if it overcomes these convictions and gets again into its old posture, if he can cure the wounds it so receives, that soul is in a sad condition. Unspeakable are the evils which attend such a frame of heart. Every particular warning to a man in such an estate is an inestimable mercy. If those warnings continue, how then does he despise God in them who holds out against them? And what infinite patience is this in God, that he does not cast off such a one and swear in his wrath that he shall never enter into his rest? Now these and many other evidences are there of a lust that is dangerous, if not mortal. As our Savior said of the evil spirit, this kind goes not out but by fasting and prayer. So I say of lusts of this kind. So Owen is saying it's the same kind of situation. An ordinary course of mortification will not do it. Extraordinary ways must be fixed upon. Now this is the first particular direction. Consider whether the lust or sin you are contending with has any of these dangerous symptoms attending of it. Now before I proceed, I must give you one caution by the way, lest any be deceived by what has been spoken. Whereas I say the things and evils above mentioned may befall true believers, let not any that finds the same thing in himself thence or from that conclude that he is a true believer. These are the evils that that believers may fall into and be ensnared with, not the things that constitute a believer. A man may as well conclude that he is a believer because he is an adulterer, because David, that was so, he fell into adultery, as to conclude it from the signs foregoing, which are the evils of sin and Satan in the hearts of believers. So you can't conclude that you're a believer just because other believers have sinned. The seventh chapter of the Romans contains the description of a regenerate man. He that shall consider what is spoken of his dark side, of his unregenerate part, of the indwelling power and violence of sin that remains in him, and because he finds the like in himself, concludes that he is a regenerate man. If the person does that, he will be deceived in his reckoning, in the day of reckoning, most likely. It is all one as if you should argue the following. A wise man may be sick and wounded, yea, do some things foolishly. Therefore, everyone who is sick and wounded and does things foolishly is a wise man. Or as if a silly, deformed creature, hearing one speak of a beautiful person, should say that he had a mark or a scar that much disfigured him, and from that should conclude that because he himself has scars and moles and warts, therefore he is beautiful. If you will have evidences of your being believers, it must be from those things that constitute men who are believers. He that has these things in himself may safely conclude, if I am a believer, I am a most miserable one. But that any man is so, he must look for other evidences if he will have peace. Okay, that brings us to the last point of that and a conclusion there for this chapter. And does bring us up to chapter 10. But we're going to go ahead and stop there for this time. And then, Lord willing, continue on with chapter 10 the next time. But until then, go seeking from God to protect you. And may we always have protection and ask him for protection from the deception of our hearts. We are prone to, the heart is deceitful. Deceitfully wicked above all things, and we're prone to justify our sins, and may he help us not to do that, and then may we come strongly upon gospel reasons against sin, hatred of sin as sin, as an affront to God again, and may it be done out of love to him, and may we not justify these things, and may we be circumspect on our hearts to be careful that we're not fooling ourselves as to our true estate. And then may we seek God for his graces in, first of all, salvation, and then to help against sin in this mortification process. And Lord willing, We will talk to you again soon.